Faith Strong Today presents WikiGod with Mark Grollo. Hear new episodes every Wednesday and subscribe to the podcast at faithstrongtoday.com.
Well, hey friends, this is WikiGod, our stories shaping God in Toronto. And I'm your host, Mark Grollo, and this is the uncut Faith Strong Today edition of the show. So come on and WikiGod with me. It's okay. This is a safe place to say you're not a know-it-all, and that's not a bad thing. You haven't heard everything there is to think about God. You don't know every idea out there. And that's why we talk to each other. We wiki each other's stories, each other's ideas. We think that we hear someone else talk about their thoughts about God. We explore maybe new horizons of what might be possible for us, our thinking and our doing. And we're doing that this week once again. We're wikiing God with Krista Heslink. Krista is an ordained minister, director of BIC Canada's Next Generation Engagement. BIC Canada is the denomination that I'm affiliated with. Krista is a speaker, a blogger, and most recently she is the author of a book called Life's Great Dare, Risking It All for the Abundant Life. And man, it is a doozy of a book. I highly recommend it. Krista sits down with me and talks about how she came to work in the church, how she started writing a book about transformation in her own life, and then opening ever wider into discovering full expression of what the good news means for her and for the world. So she shares, man, she's vulnerable here. She shares the pain of losing a sibling and fighting cancer and the miracle, really, of transformation in the middle of deep pain. She talks about her revisions of God over the years, something I can relate to, and really culminating in addressing the one deep human question that we all ask, a question that resonates in all of us. And I'm not going to give it here. Spoiler. No, I'm not going to do the spoiler alert. I'm going to let Krista talk. So without further ado, let's get right to it. What a conversation. Let's wiki some God right now with Krista Heslink. Krista Heslink. It's been a long time coming.
I know. Hi.
My goodness. And, you know, I guess full disclosure, we used to be colleagues. You can fully disclose that you've been listening to the podcast.
Yes. I'm a huge fan, actually.
All right. Well, now you're on the mic. So let's go back, you know. You know how I do this,
mm-hmm.
little Krista.
Mm-hmm.
So where are you from?
Yes.
What was growing up like?
Well, I grew up in a really small town.
Oh,
so
great.
This is how I usually say it. I did a speech in grade 6.
Okay.
About my town, and there were 652 people living in the town at that time.
Wow. And what percentage of the population showed up to hear your speech?
You know, two-thirds. No, what? not quite that high, but a lot. It's a small town, and so it was incredibly...
652 people?
Yes, in grade 6.
Wow.
Yes.
What did Mom and Dad do in that town?
So Dad was the grocery store guy.
Nice.
And his family, my grandparents, immigrated when he was 6 months old.
Okay.
From the Netherlands.
Okay.
And 3 months afterwards, my grandfather fell out of the barn. So they were coming to farm like every other Dutch immigrant, and he was paralyzed instantly.
Wow.
And it was a pretty significant, obviously, turn for my family, because they couldn't farm anymore. Mm. And what were they going to do there in Canada? But they really had a sense that they needed to stay,
yeah,
not go back. So they started a dry goods business and
wow,
sold to Dutch farmers and Dutch folk, learned the language, and then sort of emerged into the grocery store in this little town.
Huh.
And then my dad took that over when
wow,
he was like 19 or 20 years old.
So you have early memories of toddling up and down the aisles? Or?
Well, I mean, I remember just being very free as a kid. I could play anywhere in town. And I did, and I knew every, you know, hiding spot.
Yeah.
And it was like seriously kind of like Little House on the Prairie.
Yeah.
On a lot of ways, it's like, come home when the streets light come on.
Wow.
I'm like, yeah, yeah, I will. And, you know, just had a great childhood growing up. So
the grocer's daughter. Everybody.
The grocer's daughter. That's right.
Sounds like a novel.
Mom never worked outside the home. And
okay,
so just really took very, very good care of my brother and mine, my father. And it really was a... When I think back,
idyllic.
It's like, it's idyllic, charmed,
yeah,
very, very sheltered,
hmm,
protected. childhood.
You haven't said the name of the town.
Oh, like it's Drayton.
Like you're protecting it or
no,
something.
Not at all. It's Drayton. I say it proudly. Yeah.
Drayton. Okay.
Drayton. It's a small rural village.
Oh, okay.
North of Kitchener.
All right.
Yeah.
You recommend that everyone go for a visit.
I actually do. It's fantastic. There's a famous theater there now.
Okay.
Which started when I was in high school, and I worked at the theater. My brother worked at the theater. My dad's on the board.
Like a live theater.
It started as a small deal, and now it's Drayton Entertainment Group. So
wow.
Anyone in Ontario who's into theater will know about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. So that's Drayton. It's a great place.
So does this mean that you were kind of the Christian Reformed duchy?
No. So here's where it gets great. I feel like I can, a lot of people think I am Christian Reformed background, partly because I went to Calvin College in my undergrad, but my dad is Dutch and grew up in the RCA, Reformed Church of America.
Okay.
And my mom is Canadian and grew up in the Presbyterian Church.
Mm.
So when they got married, they decided that they would go to the United Church.
Whoa.
That was the decision in town.
Okay.
To go to the United Church. They weren't going to sort of go to either one of their own sort of tribes.
Did Drayton offer those?
There was a Presbyterian church and there was a Reformed. I think there were 7 or 8 churches in this little town when I was a kid. Yep.
Wow.
So we went to the United Church and I grew up in that church till I was 13.
Huh.
And then we moved to the Reformed church where my dad had grown up.
Okay.
So a lot of kids in my town, you know, everyone sort of grew up and went to church. That was sort of the thing. A lot of the Dutch folk in the area, especially going to the church that my dad grew up in and the Christian Reformed church, were all farmers. And went to the Christian school. But I never went to the Christian school. Mm. I always went to the public school system. Was, a town kid, not a farmer's kid.
Yeah.
But Dutch, because my dad was Dutch. My grandparents immigrated. Uh-huh. He owned the grocery store. So I didn't realize that I was sort of a mutt straddling those worlds until I was older.
Wow.
You don't really realize it. But my dad also did not grow up on the farm, right?
Okay.
He grew up as a Canadian kid, which was very, very strange from every other person he went to school with.
Huh. And so the Hesslinks were oddballs in town.
Well,
a little bit.
Gosh, you know, you could probably, depending on who you ask, people would be like, oh, they're more than oddballs. But, you know, I didn't think I was an oddball. I was a regular kid. I had a great childhood, honestly.
Yeah, that's great.
It was great.
So good to hear that.
I know it is. There's good nothing. To hear that.
So few people can say that.
And I'm very grateful for that. I think that there's something that gets incredibly formed incredibly early when you come from a place of feeling really safe and loved. And, you know, so when I was 13, we went to the Reformed Church, or 14-ish, went to the Reformed Church. And had a great high school experience there. I became a Christian in the United Church.
Okay.
It was really sort of this, like, very cool moment.
Yeah, I was going to ask, is there a come-to-Jesus
There was
moment
a come-to-Jesus moment.
I didn't expect it to be in the United Church, because I thought the Reformed, they want to, like, do that kind of formal stuff, the confirmation
Actually, what's interesting is, in the United Church, it's called confirmation.
Hmm.
So it's sort of like every kid, when they're going into grade 8, goes into this confirmation class.
Okay.
And there was 3 of us, right? There's three kids. I mean, there were 5 in my second grade class. So there was 3 in the Sunday school class going into grade 8. And we had this summer confirmation class with our youth leader and the pastor. And it's a very significant moment for me, because we were sitting there. I had been to church my whole life.
Yeah.
Sunday school, choir, youth group, the whole thing. And my pastor at the time, he just had this really simple illustration. He walked outside of the room and closed the door and just started knocking.
Hmm.
And we were like, and he was an older guy, and we said, hey, come on in. And, you know, we're just being jokey.
Yeah.
And he just kept knocking and kept knocking and kept knocking and kept knocking until one of us got up, went to the door, opened the door. I mean, it was like this. And then basically the conversation that ensued was, you realize that you're not a Christian just because you go to church.
Hmm.
Now, why that struck me as so profoundly new at 13 years of age, and I'd gone to church every, you know, Sunday of my life, it's actually very sad to me when I think about it. But at the same time, I was like, well, I'm really glad that
it culminated in that moment, though. That's...
Yeah, it was really cool. So what's even more cool, and I feel like I have had, you know, I can count in one hand the sort of unexplainable supernatural, miraculous moments. And this night was one of them. I was actually walking back from the church to my house, which was literally two blocks.
The confirmation night.
The confirmation night.
The door knocking night.
There wasn't any, like, you know, weeping and on the ground and pray the prayer now. It was literally like, do you know that, right? And and if you want to become a Christian, it's really about
opening the door
and actively following Jesus. And I was like, oh, wow, I don't think I'd ever heard that before. And, you know, they gave me a little track, you know. And I remember walking home with my friend, and we walked, and it was like we kept, I remember saying this, and I'm so thankful that I remember this because I've held on to it for many years. But I remember saying, doesn't everything look a little bit golden right now? And I kept sort of like, you can see me right now. I'm like sort of like, on my shoulders. I kept saying like, don't you feel a little bit lighter? I'm 13. I have no reason why I should be saying this other than that's exactly what I was feeling.
And who were you saying it to?
To my friend.
Okay.
Who I was walking home with. And it
was
like,
Who
was also in the class.
Okay.
And I think, I don't know. I think she probably was like, yeah. I mean, who knows? But I remember that very, very clearly. And what was interesting is that night I went home and I had this little track and a good little Krista. You know, I never have had a really, my rebellion years haven't hit yet.
Oh, man.
And so.
There goes that question.
I know. And so.
but they're coming, though.
But, yeah. Well, let's hope so. And so I remember laying in bed and being like, okay, there's this little track I'm going to read through, and it was, you know, pray the prayer. And the next morning, I have this memory where I was starting to like mouth off about a boy that was really bothering me to my mom, like saying, oh, he's so stupid. And I remember for the first time I had like a deep sense of that, like conviction, like,
wow,
you shouldn't probably do that.
Yeah,
again, like these are things I just remember.
Yeah.
And I hold them, like, they're significant for me when I go into seasons of, like, is this stuff really true?
Yeah.
I'm like, no, I had
you
a really...
remember the shimmery night
I
and
really
the conviction.
Had a, yeah,
the,
I had a profound sort of moment in those moments. So anyways, that, I became quite serious about my faith in high school.
Wow.
So I did that. And
okay.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Uh-huh.
And then you moved churches, though, and that was
we
okay?
Moved, that was great.
What was the impetus behind that?
You know, my family was sort of processing things and we're just in a disagreement with the leadership of the church on some things. Okay. So, you know, I'm a 13-year-old kid, so I'm following my family.
Yeah.
And it felt significant at the time. But was kind of seamless in the sense of I liked to get involved in things.
Yeah.
I was extroverted, easy to get along with. So I just found my new way in this new youth group. And really sort of loved it. I think that I did remember having this distinct, different feeling of like, oh, now this isn't going to sound maybe judgmental about my experience in the United Church, but I definitely had the experience of like, oh, these people, like, they take their Bible really seriously here. Like, and that was my experience as like a teenager, 14, 15. And I'm like, I think I want to do that too.
Okay.
So, you know.
And that culminated in Calvin College.
So then, well, actually, then...
I mean, we're skipping. Reducing a bit.
Yeah, but the only thing that I would say is really significant to my time going to Calvin is when I was in grade 10, during that whole transition of moving churches, the CRC pastor in town moved into town and had a daughter my age, Monique, which is actually my best friend today.
Wow.
So she's my oldest, longest, and best friend.
Huh.
So, Monique, love you.
Shout out.
Yeah. No, she, so we just became instant friends, sort of really bonded by our faith. We both kind of were in high school. We were like, she went to the Christian school. I didn't, but we hung out on the weekends because, you know, we just kind of were choosing to do things that other kids weren't, which was not party and get drunk and sleep around.
Yeah.
So we were like, okay, we're good friends. And then, and her whole family, of course, went to Calvin. I'd never even heard of this. In fact, I didn't even know there was such thing as a Christian liberal arts university.
Right.
But we went and visited, and I was just like, this is for me. But I, again, being very, very sheltered, very naive, you know, there was about as many people in two of the dorms on campus as there was in my whole town.
Wow, yeah.
But I went off to Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Cool.
And I had a phenomenal experience.
Yeah.
Like it was really incredibly formative. So I'm like,
I was
living
there
a couple
years ago at the Festival for Faith and Writing, and it's really something there. It's interesting. I get a sense that there's like, currents of like conservatism and liberalism.
Yeah.
And, like, it seemed very vibrant. And yet there's that deep liturgical tradition.
That's
like
right.
When you go to the chapel.
Yeah. No, I mean, you don't really know what you don't know when you're 19 and 20 and 21 years old. But when I think about that season of my life, it was, for me, incredibly powerful because I was for the first time feeling like I had a massive group of people who kind of thought the same way I did about God.
Okay.
I wasn't the weird one who was trying to like live for your faith in high school. I was like, oh, this is great. And of course, you know, some of my friends remind me that I was incredibly naive when when I arrived. So here would be an example. I don't even think you can still order pizza for delivery in Drayton today.
Okay.
Like at all.
Huh.
There's one stoplight, but that came while I was in university.
So when a guy showed up with pizza.
Well, no, I was giddy when I could find out that we could actually order pizza. So I think it was like the second week in and my roommate was like, you want to order pizza? And I'm like, to here? To this room?
Like a person will bring it?
Yeah. You know, and so people were like, where are you from? You know, and my first time like driving into Chicago, I remember that was my first semester.
Yep.
You know, gobsmacked. Like I had no concept for it at all. So, you know, I definitely am not nearly as naive.
I remember
now,
that moment in my mid-20s when I moved from Ottawa to Korea. I was kind of like that. Like, there's tall buildings?
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, exactly. So it was like summer camp for me every day. And I would call home and every week I'd be like, Mom and Dad, this is like the best week ever.
It's so good.
You know? And obviously it wasn't like perfect. There was classic hard days, but I over that whole season, incredibly profound for me.
So what did you think you wanted to do when you grew up? Like, did you have a sense of, okay, I'm taking an undergrad now and then I'm going to get another one? Because you talk about going to graduate school. Like, did you start to get a sense of what you wanted to do or what you wanted to be? Or did you want to get out of that little town and be somebody?
No, I never had that sort of like, I would have never articulated that ambition, but I was itchy to like do more.
Okay.
So the nice thing about growing up in a small town is, you know, if there are any leadership opportunities to do more, you can do it. Like you sort of rise to the top and like, hey, what do you want to go on that Rotary exchange or do you want to go? And so, and those were great opportunities for me. Yeah. I never felt like I was lacking in that.
So what were you taking? What was your
I knew I thought I wanted to be a teacher since I was a little girl.
Yeah.
Teacher. So I taught skating and I taught piano and
nice.
I just wanted to be a teacher. And I looked into the program at Calvin based on, can I go to school in the States for a teaching degree and come back to Ontario? So that was my plan. And I got into my second year about how to teach kids how to do stuff.
Yep.
And I just knew I hated it. Like, I hated every class I was taking. So I had a little bit of like, wow, this is interesting. And so I decided that I would become a rec major.
Okay.
Which to my folks were just, what is that? What do you do? And even some of my friends were like, you just play all day. And I was like, well, no, but kind of. So in the rec program, there's rec therapy, therapeutic recreation, there's outdoor ed, youth ministry was a stream within the rec department at Calvin. So I think I started translating in my own mind that I want to influence people by being a guide, right?
Yeah, I was going to say it's almost like, even if that profession didn't materialize in your life, that really flagged your interests really well.
It did.
Like, you're kind of outdoorsy. Yep. I picture you in hiking boots a lot.
Yes, exactly.
Like, you're a wreck kind of person.
Yeah, but I had never heard of it before.
Right.
And in Drayton, like, if you want to influence anybody, you're kind of a teacher in terms of, like, kids and teaching. Yeah. And so I made that switch, and I went through the youth ministry stream with a rec major and graduated thinking, I'm going to be youth ministry. And I got my first job in Rochester, New York at a Christian Reformed church. You know, I wasn't a pastor because I don't think that was allowed then, or maybe even still, I'm not sure. But I was the youth director in charge of youth and the education program.
Okay.
That's what I did right out of school.
Wow.
And I worked at camps and all that good stuff in between.
Lots of time outdoors.
Lots of time outdoors.
It
loved it.
and so you took another degree, though. Is that...
Because
you write briefly about it.
Well, I...
Because I know you also have an MDiv.
Yes. So I when I was in doing youth ministry, again, I never really had a paradigm for graduate education. Like my parents didn't have a bachelor's degree, so I was like sort of the first in the family. But I, of course, heard about graduate education. Mm-hmm. And I originally was signed up to go to Fuller.
Okay.
In their youth ministry program.
California.
So I started. Yep. So I, but it was correspondence. It was like, I don't know, a certificate or something. And so I had just started that process and halted that because of life circumstances. Mm-hmm. And we can maybe get into that later.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. And so, yeah. So 27, 28, that's how old I was when I thought, no, I'm not going to do youth ministry with Fuller, but I'm really interested in doing more education.
Okay.
So I ended up getting my Master's of Arts in Leadership at Trinity Western.
Okay.
So I graduated in 2004 with that.
And that's because you wanted to do something with it or just do more school or?
Well, I was interested in learning more, you know, in a formal context, and started looking at different programs and had always been identified as a leader in my circles and was interested in learning more about that.
Yep.
And they had a concentration stream around student development in higher ed.
Mm.
And again, that really did interest me, partly because of my fantastic experience at Calvin, but also my job at the time was working at Redeemer University College in Ancaster.
Okay.
So I was doing student development work in the higher education setting, and you know, it wasn't terribly thought out, to be honest. I was like, yeah, I want to learn about that, and I guess I'll sign up. And you know, I kind of wish, you know, I loved the degree. I learned a ton. But
so with all this leadership-y stuff, did that ever like put you at odds with some of the like Christian reform circles you're in about the whole women in leadership thing? And when does the meeting house come into play? Because you and I mean, that's how we met.
Yeah.
What was that?
Well,
did you ever feel any like tension or glass ceiling or?
Oh, that's a loaded question.
What brought you to the meeting house where I met you?
Sure.
Because that's a denomination that
I
thought with a name like Brethren in Christ. I mean, when they approached me to come on, and I told Tim Day and Paul Morris, like, no, I'm not going to be in your non-women affirming denomination. And they were like, what are you talking about? Where do you get that? And I said, well, Brethren in Christ, obviously with a name like that.
Change the name.
And they said, no, that's just the name. But I'm just, for somebody like you who's so marked early on, and even in the Reformed, it sounded like they weren't casting you aside or anything.
No, and this is where I think a little bit of that naivete and then in context, right? Mm. So in the RCA, the Reformed Church, they're further ahead on the women in office, you know, conversation than the Christian Reformed Church is, even though Calvin's CRC. But then when you go into the Christian Reformed Church, connected to Calvin College, I'm also in a education setting, a higher education setting, probably much more progressive than the average, with so much more freedom than the average sort of classes is what they call them with the CRC. So at school, I was like, I'm asked to be a leader in everything.
Yeah.
So there was no real issue. And I never really aspired in my mind to be a pastor, like a real pastor.
Yeah.
And so even going to the Christian Reformed Church, it didn't even strike me that my title wasn't youth pastor.
Yeah.
Until I ran up against other people who was doing the same job I was, and they were youth pastor. And I was like, and there were women.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, that's interesting. I guess we don't even really, you know.
Yeah. Okay.
Think about that.
It didn't get your goat.
No,
or
it
anything.
Did not get my goat at all, because I hadn't hit the ceiling on my leadership.
Okay.
So going to the meeting house, for me, I was working at Redeemer at the time, coming off of a really, really painful few years and needing to find a church that I could, quite frankly, stomach. You know, I just needed to find a place to land.
Yeah.
With people my age, and the meeting house had just launched their first regional site in Hamilton.
Mm.
And so I went, because I was finding a church, and I sort of had that moment of exhale of like, oh, this is where I need to be.
Yeah.
You know, I there were things that I was hearing, and experiencing, whether it was in home church or even from the teaching, that I was like, I've never heard of that before.
Hmm.
So I love Jesus. I've been a Christian for a long time. I've had a school in Christian liberal arts, and yet I have never once heard the peace position articulated, like not even once.
Yeah.
And I just remember thinking,
Jesus said that?
What? So for me, it stimulated my mind in terms of thinking through things.
But then it must've made you wonder what else is in there that you'd never heard about.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And then at that point, of course, you're starting to get, I'm getting older too. So you're starting to sort of care about the different things.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I started working at the Meeting House. I quit the job at Redeemer. And a couple years after I started going, I got hired.
Okay.
Initially as a contract role for the youth position, because I just needed a job and I could do that. And then in that contract, they said, would you like to be a lead pastor at the Brampton site?
Hmm.
Well, I kind of was like, are you sure I can do that? Like, I don't really know what I'm doing. They're like, we think you can. Okay. So, you go through the whole interview process and if you think I can, and I'm about to turn 30 and this should be a challenge.
Yeah.
And I got into it and I hated it.
Yeah.
Like deeply hated it. Sorry, Brampton people. Because part of it was because I was in Brampton, honestly. And part of it was the role. And part of it was just where I was at in my own life.
Yeah. And it culminates in you, marching into Tim's office.
It was actually, I was sitting on a park bench up at Camp Kako with Brux.
Okay, yeah.
And I just said to Brux, I'm like, I really don't like this. And I've been on this ride for a while, and I don't think it's because I'm getting used to it. I just don't think I like this ride.
Yeah.
And to be quite honest, what was pressing up against me was I was really struggling with being seen as realizing that I should feel comfortable with being seen as that spiritual leader of authority called the pastor of this church.
Okay.
Which that was really the first time where I was like, I've never seen a woman do this before. Okay.
The mantle was just too...
It was too much.
Strange.
Plus, quite frankly, the job is, I don't know if I was completely equipped for it. Uh-huh. And I had other things going on in my life that just made it... there was just a rub in it.
Yep.
I think if I was to do it now... Well, I have done it since I've been a sort of interim lead pastor at the Meeting
Utility
House.
Utility player.
Yep. Yeah. I was the Swiss Army knife for a while, so I don't have an issue with it now. But that was the first time I was like, ooh...
That wasn't the time when you went into Tim's office and put your name tag and whatever on the desk and was like, I'm out of here. That was another time.
Well, I did that. And then we had the conversation
with
Tim.
You did that
Tim
about
and,
the Brampton
the
thing.
Whole
okay.
thing. Yep. And then
I just remember that gun and badge scene from your story. I forget where I heard it.
Yes. And I said, I love the church. This is my church, but I will never, ever work at this church. Mm. I can't. I'm never going to be a pastor again.
Yeah. That
never
didn't happen.
Say never. And I really have learned to not do that.
Yeah.
Because.
So then you became the compassion pastor at the Meeting House.
Well, I worked at World Vision for 2.5 years
when
I quit, which was incredibly instrumental. And then I moved out of Brampton to Burlington, was still sort of doing the World Vision thing, and loved that job, actually. Like, no issues. But then Tim sort of said, I have a job for you. And I said, we've talked about this, Tim, and I'm never going to work at the church again. And you know how it is. And he says, no, come. I actually had just broken up with my boyfriend at the time after a long relationship. And I just needed a good Tim Day conversation.
Yeah.
And so he said, well, just come for coffee. Okay, great. So I went and I literally walked in to the office thinking I'm having a cup of coffee with my friend, Tim. And he's like, just come on into this room. And it was like... There were two people. It was Rod and Daryl for an interview. I was like, what is this? And I just started laughing. I'm like, whatever. You can interview me, but I'm never going to do this. And 2 months later, I started working as the, Mission 2 coordinator, compassion pastor eventually. Yeah.
Well, congratulations.
Yes. Well, that feels like ancient history to me now.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, but that's kind of when I
met
you.
That's the trajectory.
You.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm asking because it seems like maybe in the fires of that role, and this is where kind of your book starts to be born, or you start to think, I'm going to write something down here. I'm going to put something on paper.
Well, yeah, it was in that season, but it wouldn't say it was, everything's connected.
Yeah.
I mean, 100%.
Your book is not about that, but that's when you
I
got something to say or.
Yeah. And to be quite honest, it doesn't have anything to do with my experience as a compassion pastor. I literally, it was 3 years ago, just this past Christmas that I said, I think I'm going to just write my story down.
Yeah.
Which had nothing to do with, to me, had anything to do with the Meeting House or the compassion pastor. It was the dark years of my mid-20s.
And you wanted to put those down. And we got to talk about those because you've mentioned pain a couple times.
Yeah.
And if I keep skirting around it, listeners are going to think I'm being flat out irresponsible.
Well, I'm happy to talk about it.
But can I just read you kind of parts of your book here? And that is kind of how this went. I was just like, that's good. Because you gave me the PDF pre-release. So I was just like... highlighting huge swaths and copying them in, which I can't do on an e-reader. So this is great. but right out of the beginning, I mean, you're kind of nailing the reader and saying, like, right, you too, right? Because you're like, this is from your book. You sense there's a better version of yourself out there, and you want to go after it, and you're tired of feeling the burden of trying to be better, and you don't want to give up, and you've been living a stale, monochromatic life, but you're craving the technicolor promises of an abundant life. So,
yeah.
Like, right from the get-go, you're like, your life, you too, right? Your life is like this, and I'm kind of like, yeah, yeah. Or if it's been there, or it is there, we're all like rioting on the edge of that precipice, I guess.
Yeah, I think so.
So, like, what do you think caused you? And I guess that's why I'm asking about your roles and stuff. What caused you to not only be able to articulate that struggle so well? Because I think so many people are caught up in that current, don't know what's wrong, and that's what keeps people like my wife in business, marriage and family therapy. Mm-hmm. But like you say, I'm gonna kind of take it on and then address it for me, and then also write a book about it. Like, what?
Yeah. So the impetus for the book, honestly, was I'm going to write my story down for no one but myself.
Okay.
Maybe my folks will read it. I have something to capture down here.
So it started like Dear Diary.
Well, not, it was, journal. It was actually, I was pretending like I was writing it for someone.
Okay.
So for that voice.
That voice, yeah.
Like, I was telling the story to someone, not like Dear Diary, because I have all that already done.
You have those.
But
those will be the follow-up.
So that's right. Releases. So I started that, and I loved the experience. And I was working at the Meeting House at the time. Tim was my boss, mentor, friend, and I said I just loved the experience of that. He's like, well, why don't you take a week and go write? I'm like, you're going to give me a week to go write? And he's a very wise man. And I did. And I said, so what am I going to write about? And he knew me. We had done lots of one-on-ones, processed lots of different things, and he's like, I think you should research the caterpillar, and I just think you should start there. I'm like, okay.
The caterpillar was his idea,
His idea. He says, just go look up, because we had been talking about a caterpillar and transforming. Yeah. We had been talking about transformation, but like early days. So I went away for a week, and I just started there. I was like, okay, I'm going to research the caterpillar. I don't know.
I didn't know that about the caterpillar, the thing you wrote in the book.
Like, I did, yes.
Wow.
So I didn't had no intention of writing anything, but that week was incredibly important for me. I felt like I sort of tapped into a new energy and flow and gift.
Yep.
I loved it. I loved being away. I loved cloistering up and just like, and what ended up happening was a book poured out of me, in the sense of, I mean, obviously not the whole book, I've been working on it for so many years, but that rubric of transformation was started, that I put in the book was actually started that weekend that I was gone. And it still was not a book meant to be, it still wasn't even a book. It wasn't meant to be read by anyone. And over the course of these past few years, it's become a book that's formed into what your question's about. Like, why are you writing about this? Well, it didn't start that way, but I think what informs it was, you know, like I said earlier, you know, to my advantage and detriment, I don't really have a rebellious bone in my body. I mean, I'm kind of saying now, like, creativity is my new rebellion, which I kind of love. but because it feels rebellious to me.
Yeah.
But
If creativity is the rebellion, then like who's the man that you're rebelling against? Like what?
Well, the man is like, keep in line, don't create, just be the good girl who doesn't say anything worth saying.
Right.
I think it's Coco Chanel. There's a quote. It's like, the bravest thing you can do is think your thoughts out loud.
Yeah.
I'm terrified to do that.
Okay.
Which is why incredibly ironic that I've written a book.
Yeah.
Anyways. I'm not sure where we were.
Well, that's good.
Oh, I mean, so no, what I would say is, being a pastor and having a desire to connect with people and spending many, many, many one-on-ones and coffees with people, it's always about, here's where I'm not happy with my life and I'm stuck. And where does God fit into this?
Right.
How do I change this?
Yeah.
So you have that partnered with my own sense of I'm a good girl and I always am trying to be intentional with my life. Like, I think the gift of intentionality is that you can't remain in the same place. And inertia is really significant in our lives. We just kind of, we stay put.
Yeah.
So it was really a combination of all those things. And honestly, it's it sounds hokey, but it's this mystery of like, oh, I did write a book about that, and isn't that amazing? But transformation for me is a very significant theme because of what I've experienced in my own life.
Yeah.
So it started with that story of my own life, but it turned into more than just a, you know, an autobiographical vignette. It was like a, oh, there's something here that we have to learn.
Because the beginning of your book, you're kind of like throwing so many questions at us. It starts like a Rob Bell book. People just say, all he does is ask questions of the whole book.
Right.
Your first like chapter is just like, what about this? And have you thought about this? And what if this? And what? And I'm just like, oh my goodness. Yeah, I was getting a little bit unhinged by all your questions.
Sure.
Felt like I was being interrogated. Like, get out of my head, Krista.
Well, now you know what it's like to be in my head. So that now you know what it's like to sort of be like in my head, really.
But I wanted to ask like two questions that you really kind of distill down about the good life kind of. And that's two questions. God, do you really love me just the way I am? And can I have a full life of love and joy now? Like you say that those two questions are so important. And sometimes I think I don't allow myself, as I was reading your book, sometimes I wonder if books like this, and I don't want to throw your book in a category, but it seems maybe like we're thinking about the abundant life, the full life, the good life. Mm-hmm. Is that just first world, like Western white privilege talking? I don't have to spend 4 hours going to a well or whatever. But then, of course, I wonder, like, maybe that doesn't, like, spending 4 hours going to a well with all my neighbors doesn't preclude the full abundant life either.
Absolutely.
So then I feel like I'm a racist. But
no.
Like, well, you know what I'm saying?
How
are these questions so pivotal to, I think, context? Like, it's not the good life doesn't look like, 1950s ad print.
No.
With Cadillacs and suits and that. But sometimes we think that. So what were you on to? How are these questions so pivotal? And how do you distill it down to those two? God, do you really love me the way I am? And can I have a full life of love and joy now? So I felt like that, for me as a reader, like that resistance to that. Like, no, I can't allow myself to think that.
Yeah.
That's like so privileged. But
yeah.
Then on the other hand, it's like, no, like anybody in the world should be able to pick up this book in whatever context they're in and have the full life now, because it's not about commercialism.
Not at all. And that's not what Jesus talks about when he talks about the full life either.
Right.
So, this is obviously a book written by a white woman in North America, but I have spent a lot of time in other parts of the world, the global South, with deep, deep respect for the people who I've met and the friends that I've made. I actually think it's the human question, which is, am I loved? And is this life good?
Mm.
Happy? Can I have, and happy maybe is not the best way to say it, but it's like, can I find meaning in this life?
Right.
Is there a richness in this life? What the heck are we doing here?
And I think it is important for me, having known you, knowing that you travel to all kinds of, you've been to Southern African countries and you have friends there and you've seen child sponsorships like World Vision.
Yes.
And so like, yeah, it's not that exclusive.
No. And that isn't that the message of the book is basically you have to lose your life in order to gain your life.
Yeah.
And that the goal is freedom for love. Love for yourself, love for God, love for others. It's not about having more vacation and the best house.
Yeah.
So it to me, it is the human question. And it is the human question that goes back to the story in the garden.
Mm.
It's like, why would Adam and Eve consider the option of eating the fruit?
Mm.
Well, am I really loved? And is this the best life there is?
Mm.
Maybe not.
Yeah.
Maybe I should see if there's another way. Take matters into my own hands.
Yeah.
And I think that is... I just think it's the human question. And for
me... So what did they choose?
Well,
do you think?
I think they chose...
Not just
their
piece
own
of fruit.
Way.
Okay.
Yeah, I think they chose They chose to consider that God wasn't the answer.
Hmm.
They chose to consider that life in God, with God, it wasn't enough.
Mm.
And that abundance of love and richness and meaning actually comes elsewhere. And and I think that's really the message of the book, which is the abundant life, the true life, the meaningful life, the rich life, the life that really is about love and joy and peace and meaning is not apart from God. Mm. And it's always about more love, but it starts with God loving us, and it's always for the purpose of us experiencing more of the love that God has for us.
Yeah, that was kind of one of those record player moments for me, when I was reading along. Because again, at the beginning, when you're just doing the left and right, pounding away with questions, I knew enough that this was one of those kind of profound questions where I just had to kind of stop and say, whoa, there's something here.
Mm-hmm.
So you ask, what if transformation wasn't about God making me more perfect so that he could love me more, but instead, what if it's about changing me so I can experience God's love more perfectly? And I don't have a question for that, right now. Just like, I just kind of stopped reading and I said, I just remember being in counseling like 8 years ago, mm-hmm. and like having to work through this of like the idea of trying to be better. And I mean, the counselor just said like, wow, you talk about grace and you even show it to others maybe, mm-hmm. but you have no grace for yourself. Mm-hmm. Like, do you even understand
mm-hmm.
what grace means or mm-hmm. is about for you?
Yeah.
And I was just like, I don't think so. I guess not.
Well,
so you ask the question, and then near the end of the book, you kind of slam dunk it and say, God isn't transforming me to be more perfect so he can love me more, which is how I grew up, frankly.
Sure,
so you like just nailed, like, right, you just went right into my spot there. And he's transforming me so I can experience his love more perfectly. And that gives me a sense of like, oh, it's about me plugging in better to this whole world.
Yeah.
It's not like I'm a problem to be solved for God.
It's incredibly liberating.
No question.
I know. I have that same sort of like, holy crap moment.
Yeah.
When that sort of became more solidified for me. And it solves the problem for me, which is like, what is the point of transformation in the first place? Like, why do we feel like we want to be pulled towards growth?
Right.
Why do we want to long for the abundant life? What's the point of the abundant life in the first place? Yeah. Why?
Or even a question that's put even more hostile to Christianity is like, if God made this broken car,
right,
why is it on me to get it fixed? Like,
right,
screw you.
Right.
I'm the broken car you made.
Yeah.
Like, that is kind of, that's how some people discredit this whole thing.
Right.
And you're like, well, no, it's not about God needs to do that. And that is taught. You and I probably both have heard that teaching in Christian circles.
I mean,
fix yourself up because God can't stand your putrid smell.
Well, and I'm
smell.
Totally depraved in every possible way. Yeah,
But then there's problems with that. Like, there's psychological problems with that, but even theological ones where you're just like, that doesn't make much sense when you press it.
Well, and it, you know, it speaks to intrinsic motivation versus extrinsic motivation, right? Like, I would look at passages about the fruit of the Spirit, I want a life of more love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, you know, the whole gamut, right? And I would think through, how do I get to that? How do I become more gentle?
Mm.
How do I become more? And I always came back to, you know what? There's a woundedness in me. There's broken places in me. That's undeniable. But the healing of those places, the transformation of those places, is actually an interior work. And that's what actually makes me more gentle.
Yeah.
So I can act more gentle from an exterior motivation or recipe of, you know, do this and you'll be more gentle. Yeah. And we teach kids how to do things by giving them external rules and things like that. But really the fruit that I want to flow out of my life, that I think we're all sort of being created for and transformed towards, it's an interior thing.
Yeah. Well, and I appreciate this book just from a standpoint of being a daughter, a father to a 3-year-old daughter who's starting to ask questions like this.
Right.
And I just love that that's something that I could actually say to Oka, like, why should I be kind, Daddy? Because you're like, be kind, just don't rip that toy away. Like, but just when, as it becomes more sophisticated, why should I be kind? Is it extrinsic? Well, because then you'll get what you want in life.
Right.
Because polite people get farther.
Yeah.
Or is it so that the abundance, so that you can experience God's love more abundantly and people more fully. And,
Yeah, it's an incredibly good message.
Yeah.
It's a Like, it's good news for a reason.
And you look like it was handed to you. You're like, where did this come?
Well, it was a slow unfolding. Yeah. I mean, the Camino had a lot to do with it. Yep. We can talk about that, but I mean...
Well, we're running out of time. We keep saying we're going to talk about stuff.
Yeah.
And then that's setting up expectations that we have to talk about.
We don't have to talk about that.
Can I talk about kind of God, your God? Because I really... It's very interesting for me, the podcast, Our Story Shaping God. You write at one point, my pain was too big for the God I'd come to know. All right, we're coming to the pain. All
sure,
right?
So sure, we sure. talked about, sure.
I could no longer have a relationship with that version of God. I needed to deconstruct my understanding of God to rebuild a more durable, more accurate understanding of who he actually was. One, I had to leave him, or at least my understanding of him, and unravel everything I knew. Like, that's interesting because, again, yeah. I know you're that.
Yes.
That happened to me.
Yes.
And that's one of the reasons for my subtitle of this podcast, you know, Our Story Shaping God. Mm-hmm. You, in a way, had to let a different God get shaped in your mind and in your heart out of your experience. So
yeah.
What was that process like to kind of... Because you're not literally letting go of a God and picking up another one. But when God is so one thing, and then your experience is, oh, is God that? And now I have to kind of rebuild or recalibrate who God must be.
Well, and for me, that version of God was the presence of pain means the absence of God. Because there's... pain means there's no joy, there's no comfort, there's no peace.
Okay.
So I was always...
So pain is the antithesis to God's presence.
And so the presence of God was the presence of comfort, joy, and peace. Well, I didn't experience any what I would consider comfort, joy, peace, solace after losing my brother, right?
And you write about that.
I do. I share my story sort of in the middle of the book because I don't want it to be about me, the book, but it's the hinge of transformation that's death to new life.
Yeah.
So that it just didn't hold. And so I didn't realize that at the time, what it really just felt like that God had abandoned me completely.
Mm.
And it was devastating to me that God would do that when I needed him most.
Yeah.
So it was incredibly painful, incredibly dark.
That's what's interesting to know you.
Yeah.
And then to read that chapter of your life, it's like,
yeah. This is 17 years
ago
now.
I didn't know the intensity of it for you.
Yeah.
I didn't. I mean, that is my greatest fear, to go through something that that I feel like, I think of my losing my children or something. It's just like, I think I'd be done. And I've actually talked to people on the street, like homeless folk.
Yeah.
Like, what brought you here?
Yeah.
And, oh, like a car accident.
Sure.
Like, oh my God.
Sure.
You know? And so that is a real fear of mine.
Yeah.
So then for you to write about your pain and coming through it with God, I don't know, it helped in a way. It was amazing to me that, like, oh, Krista survived. You're more than surviving.
Yeah.
And the pain of missing Todd and, of course, going through chemo and the cancer that still has, like, effects, echoes in your life.
You
carry it with you.
Yeah, I mean, you always cope. I'm still coping, you know, absolutely.
Yeah.
But
to be able to talk about an abundant life even after that.
Oh yeah. That's the miracle though. That's why transformation is such a crazy, real time, miraculous, beautiful concept that I can't stop thinking about and I'm enamored with, because I have been face down in the death zone, ashes, never to see the light of day.
Yeah.
And stayed there for a long time. And to now, many years later, see that actually, I've not only been brought out of the pit, but the pit has been the birthplace for some incredibly beautiful, important things that actually leads to more love for God, for myself, for others.
Yeah.
So that's why.
But we're afraid of the pit.
Well, and we should be afraid of the pit.
Yeah.
It's an awful place.
Right.
But. You know, I mean, the pit, the death, the dying to yourself, the lose your life to gain your life, that looks like a whole bunch of different ways.
Yeah.
For me, I experienced a very, very significant sort of legitimate real-time death of my brother and my health. But, you know, you experience these places of letting go of control.
Yeah.
and a death of a habit, a death of an attitude, a death of something that's getting in the way of a whole life, a full life, a beautiful life.
Yeah.
We have that in, you know, all areas of our life all the time. But that is, I think, the process of understanding that God's just pulling us towards more abundance, because that's what we're created for. We're created for this beautiful life of love and joy and peace and meaning. And we do that as we become healed and more whole.
Yeah. And that was one interesting thing. You talk about, I think a friend said to you or something, but I was saved and transformed into a new creation. I was saved. I am being saved and transformed into a new creation. I will be saved and transformed into a new creation. That beautifully captures the, how can you have all three? Like what's
sure.
going on there? What is the perspective when we look at life that way? I was, I am being, I will be. What does our life look like when we have that perspective?
Yeah. I mean, for one, I think it just takes a little bit of the pressure off, right?
Mm.
It gives us the freedom to be a little bit bit gentle with ourselves,
right.
Knowing that it's a process, right?
Yeah.
Because
if it's I was, then the assumption is,
well,
you're perfect, you're good
or something.
Yeah.
It's like, I guess the thing that I think that is so profound is because it's so simple and it rings so true.
Yeah.
It's like I can look at my life and go, yes, there have been things in my life that have been changed. There are things in my life in process being changed, and there will be things that continue to be changed. But then in a more spiritual level, when you even look at scripture, you know, one of my favorite passages is 2 Corinthians 3, 4, and 5, those chapters.
Mm-hmm.
Well, right, just in those chapters alone, you have this point illustrated where you have, you know, for those who are in Christ, you are a new creation. The old is gone, the new has come. So I was saved and transformed.
Yeah.
But then, you know, I am being saved and transformed. I think it's the end of chapter 3, the last verse. It's like the Spirit of the Lord is freedom, and God is always in the process of changing us.
Mm.
That's the Krista paraphrase.
Yeah.
You know, and then in chapter 5 or end of 4, I think it's beginning of 5, it talks about the earthly tent being taken down and this hope of one day being renewed. It's like, and I will be transformed. It's like we're talking about in the span of, you know, maybe 35 verses.
Yeah.
This concept is
so it's not a contradiction. It's a trajectory.
Yeah.
It's a
And it rings really true. Mm. And I think it should provide hope. I think for all of us that God is always in the business of transformation.
Mm.
Where he's always wanting to renew and remake.
And it's all about love. You just like
it is always about
that. You put that right up at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah, it is. And I would say that to me that's that's a newer idea for me
for
to
you.
Really soak in. Like, oh yeah, I mean it's a beautiful idea, and I'm completely enamored with it right now. But
yeah, well, when you wrote, "You and I are not transformed so that we can experience freedom from our old ways." I mean, to me, that implodes 80% of Sunday sermons in churches across the nation about...
right? It's like, it's not a self-help
book. That's what you'll hear is you're transformed so you can be free. And
mm-hmm.
we love freedom, and that gets us going. But you said, no, we're freed up from our old ways so that we can love better.
Yeah.
You can't jump from rebirth to love, because we can only love well when we have experienced the freedom that comes from being loved ourselves. You're like, you're beaming at your own words. Because that's such good news, right?
It is such good news. I just think, like, yes. And
when I read your book, you're like, did I?
I know. When I think the thing
because it's like good news from somewhere else. Like
it's
when you
good
read
news
that.
From somewhere
it's,
else.
It's not your typical self-help wisdom,
no,
like
that's
you
right.
say.
And I
it's
think that gets that. What gets me more excited. I actually just had this conversation this morning.
Hmm.
If I was to write the book again, I would say exactly the same thing. The points would be the same, but I would say it differently, only in that I would use language that would be more accessible to people who get really hung up on the Jesus language.
Okay. But I felt like you were like,
I try to do that.
You're not a God person. Can we use that word? And I really love that. Like, I'm a process theology guy.
Yeah.
Like, you're just like, can we just use that word? Even if you're not into it for the great lure towards love or the thing that you want to
That's
be better.
Right.
That was so great.
Oh,
good.
Like, and I really do. Like, I do think the book is accessible to people who are absolutely like open to seeking and But I mean, I am a Christian. I come from that worldview, and that's going to absolutely ring true. So you got that.
I got that impression. I wasn't like, she's like, this is all Christianese, a jargon. I can't even make my way through it. because this is the kind of message that could help, again, not to get too close to that self-help language, but anyone.
Well, no, it helps because it's transformative. It actually is.
Well, it's freedom from the freedom myth.
Yes,
which I like.
Right.
Like,
that's right.
It's not about, you're not transformed so you can be more free. And then you're like, what do I do now with all this freedom? It goes back to what we said. Do I get the bigger condo now and the better? It's like, no, it plunges you right back into loving better, which, you know.
Loving yourself better, loving others better, loving God better. Right. And like, people love to love.
Yeah.
People love
to love.
Love to love.
.com or something.
No, just love to love. The Love to Love Project.
All right, there you go.
Yeah.
We're actually coming to the end of our time. I cannot believe it.
No problem. This has been fun.
Could I just ask you a little bit about what you do? You got like flow internships on the go through the BIC.
Yeah, that's right.
Talk about that.
Yes. I quit my job at the Meeting House a little over a year ago to work part-time so that I could write the book, finish the book, and just sort of be open to pursuing that. And the other half of my time, I work with young leaders and developing them. So I do this flow internship. So flowinternship.com.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of a cool way of having a program that helps young leaders have leadership development, spiritual formation at the heart of their internship over the summer, where they kind of architect their own program and have real-time experience in churches and organizations. So I just finished interviews. We're getting excited for summer 2016. So I do that. There's a few other fun things that I'm wanting to do.
With flow internship?
No, actually.
Oh, okay.
Because
you don't have enough going on.
There's another thing that by the time the podcast is out, if you go to thesparkinitiative.ca, that's a pretty exciting thing. We're going to actually do a granting process for young social entrepreneurs that are inspired by their faith to make an impact in the community for good things. So basically, we're getting behind the inspired spark of young social entrepreneurs across the country.
And that sounds like a giant bank of WikiGod guests.
Fantastic.
Those
WikiGod guests.
Amazing.
go there. Yeah. So no, I get to fill my days with lots of really good things. And I do a lot of speaking and
build a better story.
Build a better story. Yep. That's
really
cool stuff. Yeah. That's a workshop that I just basically thought, I have something that I can share that's based on my experience using Donald Miller storyline content and my own story. And just, it's been a really helpful process for people.
Yeah.
And I have another one coming up April 9th in Hamilton, and people can just check the website if they want to see what I'm doing and when.
Yeah,
I'm
your website is pretty clear about where you are, what you're doing, and it says updated regularly somewhere in bold. So
that's
we know that it's fresh.
It's somewhat fresh. Yes.
Good. So, how can people get their hands on this book? When does the book drop? When did it drop?
Yes.
I got the advanced copy, so I don't know how the average person gets it.
Okay, so the book's called Life's Great Dare, and anytime you're wondering, you can go to lifesgreatdare.com. But the book's available on Amazon.
Okay.
And we'll sort of be looking at different ways to do Kindle in the future and an audiobook and things like that. But that's, Amazon or my website. You can order right off my website, probably cheaper in some ways in that way. But I'm just learning a whole bunch of stuff about Amazon right now. So find it on Amazon, it on my website. It would be great to have the word spread about this. I self-published, so
that's
it's kind of my thing, and I'm loving it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I love the book. It's
good news. Thank you.
And I just love that it's out in the world. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
I had so many other questions, but we are kind of out of time.
No,
but did we do okay? Did we do justice?
We did.
Do you feel like?
We did. I feel like people have a sense of what the book is
and
who wrote it. And you find me online and ask any questions, and I'll be happy to answer them.
Awesome. So. There you go. For the record, expect the floodgates to open. Thanks a lot, Krista.
Thank you, Mark.
Oh, well, there you go. The full story. Krista Hessling. Wow, right? Wow. Just wow. Check out lifesgreatdare.ca to explore more of Krista's world and to get that book in your hands. Get it on the site there or wherever you get your books. And now make sure you subscribe to WikiGod on Faith Strong Today so you never miss an uncut episode of the show. To connect with me, you can fire me an email at mark@wikigodpod.com or tweet me at Mark Grollo or at WikiGodPod on Twitter. I love hearing your thoughts and engaging your feedback about stuff you're hearing here. Join us again right here on Faith Strong Today next week when we're wikiing God with John Corbin. He's a longtime hip-hop artist and music producer, and we're going to hear his story. It is quite a story. He's got awesome things to say. As for today, that's it, that's all. You don't want to miss next week. Thanks for wikiing.
Thanks for listening to WikiGod, presented by Faith Strong Today. Share this episode on social media and find more great programs at faithstrongtoday.com.